Welcome to episode 3 of our podcast. We got some great stuff coming up today. We're going to talk about the James Bond series, and this will be the first of several installments where Sam will break it down. He's a huge Bond nerd, and will tell you everything you ever want to know about James Bond and more. As always, we have a trivia question where, of course, Sam is likely going to make a fool out of me. We'll continue talking about color, finishing up our conversation from last week, talking a little bit about the artistic differences between color and black and white. I'm going to give my opinion about Spider-Man movies in a new segment we're debuting. We've got a top 6 list for you today, movies about trains, and Sam is going to talk a bit about 2 movies he thinks make a good double feature, Big Fish and Secondhand Lions. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and Stephen, I got to explain to you how excited I am about this podcast. Can I do that?
Go ahead.
Okay. If I were walking down the street listening to this podcast, and I saw ninjas on a trampoline, and they were sword fighting with each other, and they said, hey, we need a fourth, can you join us? I would say, only if I could keep my iPod on and listen to this podcast.
However, I would not recommend that, because sword fighting with ninjas, and I speak from experience, takes full concentration, and I think this episode is good enough that you wouldn't be able to concentrate on the sword fight, and you'd likely end up without a head. And then how could you listen?
It would be a sweet death, though.
True enough. Hopefully, though, this episode won't kill you.
On November 17th, the next James Bond film opens. It's called Casino Royale, and it's the 21st official Bond film, and it has a new star in the role named Daniel Craig. So to commemorate the occasion, we thought we'd do a series of Bond segments recapping the Bond series. We'll do a little bit at a time over the next several weeks until the opening of the movie. So for this first segment, we'll eventually get to talk about the earliest Bond films, but at first I want to take some time to supply some background information and tell some behind-the-scenes stories that will have long-running ramifications on the movie series. The story of James Bond starts with the story of Ian Fleming. He was a journalist and a stockbroker through the 1930s and enlisted in the Royal Navy and worked his way up to the rank of commander. Now, during World War II, he was actually involved in some espionage, though more on the planning side than being in the field. For example, one of the things he planned was called Operation Goldeneye, a name that will come back later, and that was a plan to keep in contact with Gibraltar in the event Spain were to join the Axis powers. Well, anyway, fast forward. Fleming was foreign manager for Kemsley Newspapers, and when he was hired, he asked for 2 months of vacation per year, and he'd retreat to his Jamaican estate named Goldeneye, where he would practice his writing career, that he was just going to get started going. He was going to write novels, and this is where he created James Bond, at Goldeneye, in February 1952. The character was based on people he knew from naval intelligence, but really it's just a romanticized version of himself. Now, as the story goes, he was looking for a name for this character, and the idea is he wanted a very bland, boring name. The character would go to a lot of exotic, exciting places, but he wanted the character himself to be this anonymous, inconspicuous arm of a government. So he was looking around this room, and he saw on his shelf a book called Birds of the West Indies by James Bond, and he said, well, that's a perfectly good name, so he used it. And he wrote the novel Casino Royale. And this one was darker than the novels that would follow about James Bond. The first Bond girl would be called Vesper Lind, and she was based on a real-life special operations executive agent named Christine Granville. The first Bond villain was Le Chiffre, a Smersh agent who had fallen out of favor. Smersh is an abbreviation of 2 Russian words that mean death to spies, and it was actually a real-life Soviet counterintelligence organization that existed during World War II, although Fleming's version is a bit more dramatic and elaborate. Bond would be continually running up against Smersh, more in the books than the movies. Now, Casino Royale was published in 1953, and every year until Fleming's death in 1964, Fleming would retreat to Goldeneye in January and February to write a new Bond novel. Ultimately, he wrote 12 novels and 2 short story anthologies, one of each of which was published posthumously. But the books came out like clockwork, one a year for that whole time. But back to 1953, Casino Royale attracted the notice of television producers at CBS. They bought the rights to the book so they could produce it as part of their Climax Mystery Theater show, a series of 1-hour mystery dramas. The episode aired in 1954, and Bond was played by Barry Nelson. So if you thought Sean Connery played Bond first on the screen, you were wrong. We'll talk more about this television special on a later segment in this series about Bond. And that brings us to about 1958, 1960. In that range of time, Fleming teamed up with a couple of guys, one named Kevin McClory and one named Jack Whittingham, and they collaborated on a series of drafts of a screenplay for either film or television. This committee was where Spectre and the arch-nemesis character of Blofeld was born. Now, Spectre stands for Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion. I love that name. But this committee of Fleming, McClory, and Whittingham was ultimately unsuccessful, and Fleming went off on his own and adapted some of the material they'd come up with into his ninth Bond novel called Thunderball. Now, McClory and Whittingham sued and settled out of court in 1963 for credit on the novel, because they felt that they were not adequately credited for their contributions to this story, and they were successful in that suit. Now, Whittingham fades from the picture at this time, but remember the name Kevin McClory, as he'll keep surfacing in this story all the way up to the present day. That brings us to Eon Productions, which is the production company of a couple of guys named Albert R. Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. See, in 1960, John F. Kennedy published a list of his favorite books, and the only fiction novel to appear was From Russia with Love. So overnight, James Bond became astronomically more popular than he already was, and there was a lot more interest in adapting Bond to the screen. So Eon Productions purchased the rights to basically every Bond story written to date and all future material that Fleming would write about Bond, except for Casino Royale, because those rights were already elsewhere. This team of producers were going to produce the film of Thunderball, but with the ongoing legal issues surrounding the story, they decided instead to adapt the novel Dr. No. So the question became, who would play James Bond? Well, Fleming described the character in his books as looking like a young Hoagy Carmichael, but he wanted his friend David Niven to play Bond, and his neighbor Noel Coward to play the villain Dr. No. I think Christopher Lee, who is Fleming's cousin, was also considered for that role as well. But that didn't happen. The producers offered Cary Grant the role of James Bond, and he could only commit to one film, and he said he was too old to play Bond anyway, so he passed on it. Finally, the producers decided on Sean Connery, a relatively unknown actor at the time. Fleming didn't like this choice at all. Connery was more rugged and macho and earthy than what he had in mind. But after seeing the first two movies, Fleming reversed his opinion entirely, even going so far as to give Bond of the novels some Scottish heritage as a way of expressing his approval of Connery's performance. So that brings us to Dr. No, the first movie released in 1962. It's a little rough around the edges compared to later films, but it's surprisingly established already in the character and traditions that would become trademarks of the series. There's no pre-credits narrative sequence, as there is in every other Bond movie, but the familiar gun barrel opening and instantly recognizable theme music is already present. In Bond's first scene, he's lighting a cigarette at a baccarat table and introduces himself to a young woman as Bond, James Bond. Certainly a moment that incorporates a lot of different trademarks of the series, and definitely it's one of the most quotable lines, very recognizable. It's hard to imagine the impact this movie must have had when it was released in 1962, because this is a very different kind of hero. He drinks, he gambles, he's a womanizer, and he's ruthless. In the film's most memorable scene, he holds a henchman at gunpoint, questions him for information, and shoots him in cold blood. Heroes just didn't do that in 1962, and they don't even really do that so much now. Dr. No himself would be the first in a long tradition of villains with some kind of unusual physical menace about them. This case, hands of solid steel and superhuman strength. The first movie, Bond Girl, was Ursula Andress, first seen emerging from the water like a nymph or something, and this image would become another of the most iconic images from the series. But what really sells it is Bond himself. He's actually quite a complex character. Basically, he hates his job, but he's good at it, and it's all he knows how to do, spy and kill and save the world. But he hates it, and it pushes him a little over the edge sometimes, making him dark and moody and maybe a little bit crazy. And the way he copes is to throw himself into a destructive lifestyle. He rewards himself with drink and women and gambling and smoking, and the cycle continues. Even apart from the dangers of his job, he's not the kind of guy you'd expect to live very long, which is perhaps why in the books he's perpetually 38 years old, no matter when the stories take place. The same thing ultimately happens in the movies. His age goes up a little or down a little because the actor's age and the part gets recast, but basically he's always in the neighborhood of about 38 years old throughout the whole course of his 40-plus years in which these movies take place. Anyway, Dr. No was released to theaters in 1962, and it's a big hit. Steven, what did you think of Dr. No?
Well, I like it. I was surprised. You know, I didn't really see it until last year. I think it's the first time I actually sat down and watched it all the way through. I've seen bits of it on TV. But what I was really surprised about is what you mentioned, the psychological complexity and depth of the character, because that's something that's not even necessarily present in the modern or later Bond films. The movie's kind of rough around the edges, like you say. Not all of the action pieces are quite there. And in fact, it's not really an action movie exactly at all, which I was kind of expecting, and there's no real big climax. But definitely, Bond is an interesting, dark character in this film, and I really responded to that. I like it quite a bit.
Yeah, it's always something a little special, I think, in the later movies when there's a scene or two, at least, that touches upon Bond's complexity as a character and all those inner demons and stuff that he wrestles with. The weaker movies, I think, just kind of stay light and hop from action scene to action scene. What you say about action, by the way, is very interesting. I do think James Bond is the father, or at least one of the ancestors of most modern action movies, and Bond himself, I think, got a lot of that from North by Northwest, in terms of the movies anyway, but definitely Dr. No still hasn't quite gotten up to that point, hasn't developed the action movie genre that we know so familiarly today. The next movie is From Russia with Love, which was released just 1 year later. The director is Terrence Young, who had also directed Dr. No, and the plot is a very faithful adaptation from the book, the biggest change being the replacement of Smersh for Spectre. The producers didn't want to antagonize Soviet relations by making them the villains. Now, Blofeld appears for the first time. His face is not seen, and the actor's name appears only as a question mark in the credits, so the producers were trying to build up an aura of mystery over this character that they would kind of roll out over the next few movies. Firsts for this, we get a pre-credit scene before the theme song. We also get a theme song, and the Bond movies would develop a tradition of hiring a contemporary pop artist to supply a theme song that sort of fits into this Bondian, Fleming-esque kind of world. Also, for the first time, Desmond Llewellyn appears as the character Q. Llewellyn would go on to star in more Bond movies than any other actor. Although his character, by the way, actually does appear in Dr. No. He's just not addressed as Q. He's addressed by his real name, Major Boothroyd, but he was played by a different actor. And most of the other trademarks of the series appear here as well. Oddly, though, From Russia with Love, I think, feels less Bondian than Dr. No did. Compared to the other movies, it's very low-key. It's a great film, though. Probably the strongest is an actual spy story.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point, because with the next movie, we're going to move a little bit away from the more spy espionage-type territory.
Yeah, and that, of course, was Goldfinger in 1964, so again, just 1 year after the previous one. And this is the definitive Bond film. Maybe not the best, some people consider it the best, but it's the one that I think defines Bond the most. It's the one where everything falls into place, all the pieces, all the formula that's been developing here gets smoothed out and just clicks. And it's got the first traditional pre-credit sequence, a little mini-adventure that may or may not have anything to do with the rest of the movie. It's got a deep, brassy, memorable theme song sung by Shirley Bassey. It's also got a wonderfully memorable henchman in the form of Oddjob, a mute grunt with a deadly hat. And it contains another incredibly iconic image, the Golden Girl. Actress Shirley Eaton, painted entirely in gold paint, is the way her character is killed by the villain Auric Goldfinger. Get it, Auric?
Turns out that actually painting somebody, not an effective method of killing them.
No, yeah, it actually doesn't work, but yeah, so what? So he painted her up, and her skin suffocated or something, and she was killed. But it's a very memorable image.
Since the 1960s, doctors have learned that we breathe through our lungs and not through our skin. It's the respiratory system.
Exactly. So Goldfinger himself is arguably the most memorable of all Bond villains, and certainly has one of the most memorable lines. Bond is chained up on a golden table, and a laser beam is cutting through the table and will soon cut through him. And Bond says, "Do you expect me to talk?" And Goldfinger says, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die." I don't know who watches Bond movies and can't quote that scene. Anyway, the movie is directed by Guy Hamilton, so we have a change in director. And he achieves a more polished, flashier look than Terrence Young had. And part of the movie's success is his sense of pacing. For example, there's a scene in the middle where Goldfinger gives an expository speech to his cohorts. Now, this could have been a very long, dry moment in the middle of a movie that had built up a lot of pace and would need to speed things up afterward. But instead of letting this scene sit on its own in one big chunk, Hamilton cross-cuts with Bond attempting to escape and sneak around and eavesdrop. So you get this cross-cutting, and it makes this exposition go that much quicker.
Of course, the exposition is completely senseless, because Goldfinger then kills all the people he just finished explaining it to, so it's one of those great, absurd Bond moments where the villain does something completely and totally irrational.
It's the talking villain syndrome, I think. Is that what Roger Ebert calls it? Where the villain
just
has to...
But this is even worse because he's not even...
Well, no, it's better. It's better because he gets rid of everybody he's told. A lot of the problem with this is it gives whoever he's telling the chance to go away and stop him.
Of course, Bond does overhear it. So, you know, Bond does overhear it. Against him.
Yeah. But you know what's weird about this movie for me? It was my favorite Bond movie for years. And then one day I watched it and I realized that... Jeez, Bond almost never does anything in it. Almost everything he tries to do, save the two Masters and Sisters, eavesdrop, escape capture, pass along a message, defuse a bomb, even defeat the bad guy at the end. It's all either foiled by the bad guys or gets done by somebody else. The scene with the bomb at the end is the readout, of course, is ticking down to when Fort Knox is going to blow up. And so he's got the case of the bomb open and he's paralyzed because he doesn't know how to defuse the bomb. And then you see this arm reach across and flip a switch, and that stops the bomb. So Bond is strangely passive and ineffective in this movie. He's sort of almost like just an observer to this. You see what I mean if you watch it with that in mind. So that kind of bothered me as soon as I noticed it, but otherwise I think this is a pretty great entry in the series. Now, remember Kevin McClory? About this time, the legal wrangling over Thunderball had reached a point where he's won the right to produce a movie of that story. And the producers, Albert Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, made a deal to co-produce with McClory. So McClory becomes the producer of Bond movie number 4, and Broccoli and Saltzman retreat to the status of executive producer. Now, this arrangement proved so unbearable that Broccoli and Saltzman swore they'd never co-produce like this again, and indeed, they never did. Anyway, Thunderball comes out in 1965, 1 year after Goldfinger, and Bond mania has reached its peak. It gets more admissions by far than any other Bond movie before or after. And stories tell about lines wrapping around the block. This was just a phenomenon. Strangely, this is the weakest of the first 4 Bond films. Director Terence Young returns to the director's chair, and he's good. He brings a gritty edge to the movies, but the climax is a gross miscalculation. It's this massive underwater battle between the good guys and the bad guys that just goes on and on and on. The narrative is unclear, and the action isn't very exciting, and the movie just falls apart. It's very strange. But it's pretty good up until then, and it's nice to see Bond active and capable and actually doing work again.
And of course, I think maybe one of the problems the franchise runs into, when you mentioned that big climax, is Bond is sort of perhaps one of the first... No, Bond is the first action movie franchise, but it got to constantly top itself by trying to come up with something bigger and better. And I think it's easy to see how that kind of pressure can backfire and lead to clumsy sequences that just go on for way too long.
Absolutely. In future episodes, as we revisit Bond later in the series, we'll see this happen a couple different times where Bond just gets too big and the producers have to scale it back and kind of get back to basics. So this week we've covered the backstory of Bond and seen the film series reach its commercial peak. Next week we'll talk about Bond's decline over the next several episodes to the point where it very nearly ended in the 1970s. And we'll also talk about some of the recurring characters in the Bond universe that we didn't get to this time. So check back with us next week.
We are to the point of the show where we'd like to ask you folks a trivia question. I'm going to attempt to stump Steven, which is not very difficult, and to stump all of you. So the question is about the Oscars. What Best Picture winning film did not so much as receive any nominations other than for the Best Picture category? Do you know the answer?
I know because you told it to me before, but no, I don't. I don't actually remember it.
So you don't know the answers even when I tell them to you, is what you're saying.
I mean, months ago you mentioned it to me more than once, but it was in the past.
Before the show.
Right, unfortunately.
All right, well, I will remind you of the answer later on in the show.
Well, if you remember from last week, we talked a bit about the history of color in movies and how it's been around for a really long time, since the very earliest films, and how it sort of reflects the changing nature of Hollywood, the use of color. Continuing that train of thought, we want to talk about why black and white is so compelling to us, and how maybe color is misused, and maybe how we should like to see more black and white movies. Now, there's definitely an idea, and Sam mentioned it last week, but there's this idea that a lot of people say, I don't like black and white movies. And why this is, we're not sure, but want to maybe delve into that. So one of the things we start with is, what are the advantages of color? Obviously, one of the greatest things about color is when it's done really well, it's just spectacular. You get a real sense of spectacle. The easiest example is Wizard of Oz. When they switch to the Oz scenes, it's, wow, this, I mean, it really just pops out at you that, okay, now I'm in for something cool. And, I mean, when it's done really well, you think of some of the old MGM musicals. I couldn't possibly imagine Singing in the Rain in black and white. The color works really well, especially, if you have the restored DVD where it's gorgeous, the newer print. We get more information with color. Black and white, all you have is black and white. With color, you can see more. Filmmakers can do interesting things. They can color code things or dress up characters in specific colors to represent things. They can use colors to convey information to us. Think of the woman in the red dress and how fascinating that is, or what that might mean. It might mean that this woman is dangerous and sexy, and that's something that doesn't quite come off as easily in black and white. And also, color is more lifelike. Obviously, we don't see in black and white, at least. You do see in black and white, Sam?
I don't see in black and white, no.
You have full color. Okay, I know some people are, I guess, colorblind, but I don't think anyone sees in monochrome. But definitely, it's more lifelike. So if you're making a movie and you want it to seem more lifelike, color's a good choice. But at the same time, there are some different advantages to black and white. One is, let's start with this, it's less lifelike. Why is that good? Because, you know, I live in real life. I don't need to necessarily see it in the movie screen. I like my movies perhaps to be a little stylized, and I think black and white up front tells you you're not watching reality. This is different. And the fact that it gives you less information than color, it's not as distracting. Black and white is really good at focusing on specific things, and it means that composition of shots has to be a lot more important. The way that you frame a scene, the way that you place your actors, because you can't use color to convey information. You have to just rely on the camera angle, the lenses, the lighting.
That is a good point. I do have a very definite sense of focus when I'm watching black and white versus color. I have to think about that a bit more, but I think that's a good general rule there. You're not distracted by all kinds of colors all over the place in the frame.
Yeah.
And if the cinematographer tried to design a color shot so that it wouldn't distract you so much, it probably wouldn't look very realistic.
Exactly. I mean, you can mute colors, but then you're getting into style. And so, I mean, definitely the movies, they're not real. They're trying to tell you a story in 90 minutes, and so they have to condense constantly. And black and white is great because it's not that distracting. And in fact, that's one great thing about black and white, is how good it is at contrasting things. You can cast one character almost entirely in shadow, just put, like, you know, a harsh light on him, and so half his face is in shadow, and have another character in light. That works in black and white. You can kind of do it in color, but not nearly as well, because lighting is so much more important in black and white, and so you can show contrasting characters or themes a lot easier, because black and white contrast with one another so well.
Right. The other thing you can get out of black and white is not just focusing on a character, but on a whole setting. Hitchcock was great at this in Casablanca and other films directed by Michael Curtiz. He was good at this too, where a lot of backdrops are pretty complex and cast patterns of shadows, and you get really stark lights and very dark shadows that are reflective of the mood. And I think
that's absolutely
a lot harder to do in color. You can certainly choose your colors and kind of get an effect that way, but that is a different process with a different effect.
Well, especially because in black and white, the shadows basically are they're null. You can really have a portion of the frame that's completely black. When you do that in color, it's a lot more jarring, I think. I think we accept that harsh lighting in black and white a lot easier, because we're not expecting it to look 100% real, because it already doesn't.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is, I think, one of the reasons why still photographers still work in black and white. It's not because color film is expensive, but, you know, a lot of very serious still photographers shoot tons of stuff in black and white, because it lets you focus your eye on specific things. And, you know, talking about patterns of light in black and white, take your pick of any shot from Citizen Kane, where they make such great use of deep focus, where the entire frame is in focus even though it's a large distance. You know, there's that, of course, that great shot where Kane signs away the control of his newspapers and then walks behind him to these I think they're curtains, right? Curtains in a window. When he's at the front of the frame and in the light, the curtains seem normal size, but when he walks back, because everything's in focus, it plays with perspective, and so now suddenly he's dwarfed and he's in shadow. And a scene like that would be, I think, a lot harder to pull off in color.
Perhaps, yeah. I just want to emphasize, we're not making the point that black and white is inherently better. It all depends on what kind of story you're trying to tell, what kind of emotional effect you're trying to have. Steven said you couldn't imagine Singing in the Rain in black and white. Similarly, you can't imagine Citizen Kane in color. It doesn't make any sense. They say that black and white conveys a more dreamlike sense, and I've thought a lot about that And I think that if I really think about the dreams I've had over my life, there are a couple times where I've dreamed of a vivid color. But unless I'm dreaming specifically of that, I can't remember that I've ever really seen color in my dreams. I've certainly seen the impression of color. I never woke up thinking, wow, I just saw a movie from the 30s. Mm. But the black and white cinematography does kind of take you out into that dream world where everything's not quite real, where some really extreme things can happen, might happen. Even if they don't, you might get the sense, a greater sense of dangers or unpredictable types of things. And I think that's why, one of the reasons anyway, why film noir has to be done in black and white. It really can't be done in color.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Okay. I agree with you that there are certain genres that don't work as well in color. And film noir and crime movies in general, I think, are almost always better black and white. Partially because I think in those movies, contrasts and shades of gray are important.
Yeah.
You can definitely, I mean, when your movie is gray, and gray is really the operative color in black and white, most things that you see, most images are combinations of black and white, you can really play around with it and have grays.
Do you think that's maybe why film noir went out of fashion? Because the last noir film, I think, is generally agreed to be Touch of Evil in 1958. And that's more or less when black and white stopped being very common.
Yeah, and certainly that was going to be part of it. There are some good neo-noirs in color, Body Heat or arguably L.A. Confidential. The Coen's Fargo, I think, is an interesting movie because that movie should have been black and white. I love Fargo, but it should have been. It was practically black and white as it was.
Yeah.
With all the white expanses of snow.
Well, and then they made The Man Who Wasn't There, which really was black and white. So.
Yeah. The only thing I'd like to see, I would have loved if Fargo were black and white with red blood. I think that would have been. I think. You know, it's so cool in Sin City. I think it would have been great for Fargo if they'd have had the technology at the time. Maybe they would have tried it. But, yeah, and I think noir is kind of in again, but yeah, you're definitely seeing some noir films being shot,
but it's not the same. The neo-noir, it really is a different thing, and it's good. I like some of them. There aren't a lot of great ones yet, but it's definitely a different feel from the old ones.
Maybe one thing that we should mention is I'm not so sure color should be the default choice. I think color is more interesting when you don't see it so often. I would have liked to have lived in the 30s when going to see a color picture was a big deal. You know, when you can tell Gone with the Wind is going to be a huge movie because it's 3 hours of Technicolor.
Yeah, imagine how that would have impressed people.
Most movies today, they don't really take advantage of color. You know, when you make a drama or a romantic comedy, you're probably not going to have a lot of really interesting shots. Why have it in color? Why have all that distracting visual information? Make it in black and white and save color for your big spectacles.
One interesting thing, I think the Academy understood this for a while. And in 1938, the Oscar for cinematography split in two, pretty much, and there became separate awards for black and white cinematography versus color cinematography. The first year was 1939, and Gone with the Wind, I'm sure, quite easily won the award for the color, and the black and white went to Wuthering Heights. Mm. And this continued all the way until 1967, the first year where they were joined back together and again into one award, except inexplicably, I don't know why, in 1957, I guess there was only one award as well, but that was just a one-off year. Every other year, between this almost 30-year period, there were separate awards recognizing one versus the other. And part of it is that Hollywood was making a lot of both types of movies during this period, and I don't know, maybe they were just afraid that all the voters would go for the color ones because they look more dazzling. But I would like to think that a lot of the reason for the split is because there was a recognition that these are different art forms. You can do different things with them, and they really don't compare very well.
Well, certainly from if you're the director of photography, there's a huge difference whether you're shooting your movie in color or in black and white, because, you know, one of the cinematographer's chief jobs is to light a shot, and if you're working in black and white or color, it's going to be a lot different. And if you're a cinematographer working in black and white, you don't have to worry about, you know, if you've ever done any photography, you know that lights have colors to them, and it's kind of weird. If you have, say, a bright green object in a room and it's being lit, it will cast a green light on other objects that you may not want to look green. So if you're a cinematographer working in black and white, I imagine, obviously, we've mentioned composition is more important, the lens choice and the focus is more important. I imagine it frees up some time for you to work on that kind of stuff, because shooting in black and white is a little simpler, technically. You don't have to screw around with as much stuff. And I think certainly, so then, it's not really fair to judge the work of a cinematographer when you're talking about the Oscars in black and white versus in color, because they're different gigs.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you would have liked to see Gone with the Wind back when color was a spectacle. And I think that's a lot of the reason why the musicals from that time and onward were in color pretty much all the time. I mean, I can't think of a big MGM musical after color became reasonably common that was shot in black and white.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, and I think that may just be because these were the spectacles. These were the special effects pictures of this time. They didn't have computers to come up with digital orcs and apes and things like that. They had instead these musical numbers that just had these bright colors of costumes and these elaborate sets and everything. And so I think that color was used there in order to convey that sense of spectacle and kind of capitalize on the fact that color wasn't everywhere. But we talked about how noir died roughly the same time when black and white did. Kind of the musical age ended about the time that black and white ended, because color was no longer spectacular. Of course, computers have a lot to do with that. The special effects films, blockbusters and stuff did replace musicals as well. But maybe a case could be made for the fact that color was just no longer quite as dazzling anymore.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thought. I think off the top of my head, I'd probably agree with that. That seems like certainly probably part of it. I think also, you know, changing cultural attitudes played a role in the demise of,
sure,
of the old, yeah, style musical. So anyway, I think we've done a pretty good job of covering color and black and white and why neither is necessarily better, but why we would definitely like to see more black and white movies. And I don't think it's necessarily a film snobbery kind of thing. I know there's that sort of perception that black and white movies are pretentious and boring, but not at all. For a long time, even though color existed, they were still making movies in black and white, and movies for a mass audience, and people like them. So I don't think at all it should be thought of as this sort of elitist attitude to prefer black and white for certain movies. So I think if you're one of those people that doesn't like black and white so much, you should go back and maybe watch some more black and white movies. Just, it seems a little weird at first, the same way that watching silent movies seems weird until you've seen a couple if you've grown up with sound films. But once I think you've seen a lot of black and white, you can really grow to appreciate it as an art form. So our next segment is going to be something that we're calling Controversial Take. The idea is one of us gives some sort of opinion that's kind of strange and maybe not accepted, and we kind of talk about why that person is incredibly wrong. And so I'm going to go ahead and initiate this because I am so often incredibly wrong with an opinion that I seem to be the only person on the planet who holds, and that is, I think both of the Spider-Man movies directed by Sam Raimi are pure garbage. I don't think there's much good about either one of them. The acting in both of them are okay, especially I think both the villains do a pretty good job, but just about everything else in them is completely wrong. Probably my biggest problem is the tone. They kind of alternate between total camp, which Raimi is pretty good at, and this more sort of like serious, whiny, introspective garbage where we've got to listen to Peter Parker moan and just complain about his lot in life. And man, that really drags me down. I can't stand it. And it doesn't really work. I think particularly those parts are very poorly handled. I think that's actually a problem that's plagued Raimi throughout his career, is he's not so great at maintaining a consistent tone necessarily. I think the Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness both benefit from that, where he kind of switches between horror and cheesy silliness, and that's fine because those movies, like, nothing in them is supposed to be taken too seriously. But the Spider-Man movies, I think, actually want to take themselves seriously. If you compare them to, I don't know, Singer's X-Men films, the Singer X-Men movies are how to take a comic book superhero seriously. The Spider-Man movies, at the same time, we're supposed to care about Peter Parker as a character. We've got Dr. Octopus with evil robotic arms that he designed because he's building a star in his living room. It doesn't make any sense to me at all how we're supposed to take these seriously. And there's tons of other problems. The special effects, especially in the first movie, are just horrendous. It's really bad CGI in the very first movie, and there's so many just painful moments. I think to the end of especially the first movie, where the New Yorkers are hurling rotten fruit at the Green Goblin to show patriotism, the entire movie, both movies, just filled with that kind of nonsense.
Wow, that's brutal. It's interesting that you mentioned tone. Actually, I think that was the thing that they got right. I thought it straddled the line between, you know, the X-Men movies, where you take them pretty seriously, and something campy. It's sort of in the middle, where you can kind of enjoy the best of both worlds. I guess you figured it was the worst of both worlds.
My problem is that I have trouble taking, first of all, you know, Spider-Man too seriously to begin with, and when you have these like over the top performances and supervillains, I don't know, it doesn't ever seem grounded in reality to me.
Yeah,
I mean, we're talking about the problems of a teenage kid, which first of all are pretty trifling anyway. And compared to, you know, the world's about to be destroyed by the Green Goblin or whatever, that seems to me totally inconsequential.
Well, let me tell you what I do agree with you about, and I do agree about the villains, especially the Green Goblin. They are over the top, and I don't think they really are believable and real enough to manifest the kind of threat that would really kick this into something where you'd really get involved in the story. It's not like the Superman movies with Zod and Lex Luthor. I mean, they're over the top too, but for some reason in a way that is believable in that world.
Yeah, or if you talk about the X-Men movies again, Ian McKellen's Magneto does that perfectly, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. But what I did like about the Spider-Man movies is the... You mentioned the teen angst and stuff. I don't know if I really go for that angle so much, but I did like Peter Parker's discovery of who he is and kind of figuring that out, especially in the first movie. Actually, the first movie I didn't think was so great except for this, but where he's discovering what he can do with his powers and how this spider bite has affected him. That's kind of interesting because...
Let me interrupt you there because I think that could be interesting. Certainly sounds interesting when you describe it, and I thought it was going to be interesting when I first watched the movie, but I found that sequence just incredibly dull and flat and lifeless.
No. When he's sitting in the cafeteria and he's wondering what's going on with him, and suddenly the web comes out for the first time, and he's thinking, whoa, that was scary and cool. I mean, that didn't strike any chords with you at all?
No, it's like Saved by the Bell with spider powers.
Well, the second one I thought was well put together, and the train sequence, very memorable. Doc Ock was an improvement on the Goblin. It's good stuff, I thought. I think what the difference is, really, is you're either into the characters or not, the teen angsty scene there. And if you do, then everything else makes sense because you care about it. And if not, I can see how nothing else there is going to grab you.
And I think that's my problem. Though I would like to note that I disliked Spider-Man 2 so much that I walked out of it in the theater and walked into Fahrenheit 9/11 and actually had a better time at Fahrenheit 9/11.
Ouch, that's brutal.
Yeah, and I didn't like Fahrenheit 9/11. I have since rewatched Spider-Man 2 on HBO and didn't really do anything for me that time either.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's why we call this controversial take. So we come to the part of the show where we have a top 6 list for you. When you get top 5 lists from other places and you just wish it would be a little bit more, we have a top 6 list for you instead.
That's one better than 5.
One better than 5. Okay, the top 6 topic for today is top 6 movies that take place on a train, or at least involve trains to some degree. So my number 6 title is from 1959. It was called Northwest Frontier. It was also known in other places as Flame Over India. It's a suspense film that takes place in the turn of the century British India. Rebels are trying to kill a young Hindu prince and end his bloodline. And to get him to safety, the British army must transport him across rebel-held territory by train. Also on board are the prince's governess, a reporter, an arms dealer, and a whole bunch of other characters. So it's sort of a bunch of strangers thrown together in an action film. Of course, one thing after another goes wrong, and the movie leaps from one sticky situation to another. It was directed by J. Lee Thompson, who specialized in tense adventures through harsh lands. He did The Guns of Navarone, for example, and it's one of his best films.
All right, sounds good. My number 6 film is from 1979, directed by the novelist Michael Crichton, who actually had a brief career directing movies in the 70s, and it's The Great Train Robbery, starring, among other people, Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland, and I think it may make your list, I'm not sure, but it's a fun little heist movie that is actually based on a real event that's been filmed a couple of times, and yeah, it's got a great ensemble cast, good heist, and it takes place on a train, so it met your weird train movie list. I'm not quite the train movie buff that Sam is.
Yeah, it did make my list later on at number 3. In the UK, it's worth noting it was called The First Great Train Robbery, which I suppose was to distinguish it from the 1903...
Edward and S. Porter version?
Yeah.
Which was actually the first Great Train Robbery movie.
Okay, number 5 on my list is a 1930 film called Danger Lights, which you have not heard of. As a movie, it's only okay, actually. It's pretty good in spots, but okay. Spotty acting, but a great performance by the lead, the Louis Volheim, who appeared in All Quiet and in the Western Front the same year. The reason I'm including this, though, is because of its historical significance. This is a real gem of a film for coverage of the railroad scene of 1930, and it includes some priceless footage that is both exciting and historically significant, such as a tug-of-war between two steam engines, a 100-mile-per-hour race to Chicago, and what is believed to be the only existing film footage of a dynamometer car, which was used in the steam engine days to measure the power, speed, and shake of an engine and other types of things like that. Now, the good news is that this very obscure film is easy to see. It's in the public domain and can consequently be seen on the internet for free at places like archive.org and movieflix.com.
All right, my number five movie is from 1971, The French Connection, by William Friedkin. And this is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but there is a great chase scene, and perhaps the chase scene of chase scenes, at least as far as cars go, in which Gene Hackman's character is pursuing a speeding L train, and it drives recklessly through traffic. It's one of the probably original car chase scenes, and certainly up to that point it was one of the most explosive and just still today absolutely fascinating. It's long, it's tense, it's a great moment, and it's all about a train.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a perfectly fair pick for this list. You know, even though the train's not really in it for that much of the running time, it is the dominant memory you have from that movie.
Yep.
My number four is Murder on the Orient Express from 1974, which is Sidney Lumet's great adaptation of an Agatha Christie story. Actually, it's probably not the best film for Christie fans, who are more likely to prefer David Suchet's portrayal of Hercule Poirot on television. Here, he is played by Albert Finney. But this is a treat for movie fans. It's slick and elegant, and the all-star cast is fun to watch. All-star cast, really. I mean, it has, I mentioned Finney, it has Martin Balsam, Ingrid Bergman, Sean Connery, and the list goes on.
All right. Yeah, definitely a movie that I have not seen and just feel terrible that I haven't, especially when composing this list. It's in my Netflix queue. My next movie is another train chase scene, Les Samurai, the 1967 French film by Jean-Pierre Melville, one of the great gangster film directors. It's about a hitman who is being pursued by the police, and in that sort of cool French black and white style, he's, you know, an elegant, refined hitman who loses this entire detail of police that's tailing him, and by jumping into the subway in the metro system in France, and he goes from platform to platform, from train to train, blending in with civilians as the cops try to find him and follow him, and it's a really brilliantly executed sequence. And I think it really epitomizes some of that cool French gangster flicks that they were making in the 50s and the 60s that I love so well.
Good. My number three film, as I mentioned earlier, is The Great Train Robbery. And one thing I like about this is it takes a lot of cliches that go into heist movies. Of course, at the time, they weren't as cliched as they are now. But by transporting them into Victorian England, that kind of setting, it kind of makes them fresh.
Absolutely. It deserves to be watched a little more. So my third pick is Billy Wilder's 1959 classic Some Like It Hot, starring Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, as two band members who witness a murder and in classic screwball fashion have to lamb it by dressing up as women and joining a train of an all-girls orchestra.
I hate it when I have to do that.
It's a real pain. And so, of course, on this train where they're eventually, they don't stay on the entire movie, but they eventually make their way down to Florida where they meet up with Marilyn Monroe, and Tony Curtis has to pretend to be a man, which he actually is, but he has to pretend to be a different man than the one he actually is to try and win her, and, you know, Jack Lemmon gets to get engaged to a guy. It's great fun.
And one of the best closing lines in all the movies.
Absolutely.
My number two film is from director Alfred Hitchcock. It is not Strangers on a Train, surprisingly enough. It's The Lady Vanishes. And it's a great film, probably my favorite from his early period. And the idea is that a couple boards a train, and they talk a bit with an older woman, and later on they discover she's not there anymore. She doesn't appear to be anywhere, and worse, nobody remembers her. That's a fantastic thriller, flawlessly directed. I love Hitchcock's use of sound and silence in this, especially at the time. I think sound and especially music was overused because it was pretty fresh and new, and you can play a lot with it. But Hitchcock knew that sound is most effective when it's contrasts with silence, and I really like that about this film. Anyway, it inspired a remake in 1979, and probably inspired the film Flight Plan from last year, which has a similar idea but on a plane. But the original is still the best.
Well, my number two movie actually is a Hitchcock movie as well, and it is the obvious Hitchcock choice, Strangers on a Train from 1951. Just a really fun thriller about two men who meet each other and both have someone in their lives they'd like dead. They sort of discuss it the way you might discuss that kind of thing, you know, with people sort of in jest, actually talking about how, well, if we switched murders, no one would suspect us because we could each have alibis and we don't know each other. And then, of course, one of them takes it perhaps a little too literally. And a lot of fun. It remade kind of as a Throw Mama from the Train, which is not perhaps the best train movie ever, but maybe worth mentioning.
All right, I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that we picked the same number one. Is it The General?
Well, actually, it probably should have been, but I actually somehow forgot about my favorite train movie, so no, my number one is a different great movie, but not nearly as good of a pick.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, The General is, just to give some background about it, it was made in 1927 by Buster Keaton, my favorite silent comedian, and it takes place during the Civil War, where he plays a railway engineer whose two loves in life are his engine and his girl. Well, Union soldiers come down and kidnap them both, because this is a movie, and he takes another steam engine and chases after them, single-handedly. There's a pretty clearly defined three-act structure here. He chases them, then he has some narrow escapes behind enemy lines, and then they chase him back. But it's relentlessly creative. One scene in particular really demonstrates Keaton's genius for mechanical humor. He's in the back of the train loading a cannon that he wants to shoot at the train ahead of him, and something goes wrong, and the cannon swivels down and points right at him, and the car's in his own train. Of course, he doesn't realize at first, and then he's scrambling to get out of the way. I don't want to give away how this ends, but there's a great cannon's eye view of things that's just so unexpected and so creative, and for me, this scene is the one scene I think of when I think of this movie, and really when I think of Keaton's genius at choreographing comedy in at all. Humor is really subjective, but for me, I think this is the funniest film ever made.
You know, that's pretty, I don't know if it's the funniest, but certainly on the short list. One of my favorite things about the movie is the fact that they actually ruined a real train at one point in the movie, because why use miniatures or models when you can just run an actual train off a bridge?
Sure.
And it's definitely inventive the whole way through. You would think that a chase movie set on train tracks might be a little dull, but Keaton's constantly able to keep it interesting. Yeah, it would have been my pick for number one had I not been completely retarded.
I think that he should be complimented for not resorting to the computer-generated graphics on that crash.
Yeah, it
was dedication to his art.
Absolutely. So my number one film is the Lumiere Brothers' 1895 classic Train Pulling Into a Station. No, I'm just kidding. Though that is an interesting couple minutes of a train pulling into a station. Early movies weren't that great. Anyway, my number one film is actually 1957 classic Bridge on the River Kwai by David Lean. It's a great story about British soldiers who are captured by the Japanese during World War II, and their commanding officer, played by Alec Guinness, puts up at first resistance to doing work to help out the enemy, but at the end, once he's sort of won over to the cause, decides to show the Japanese how the British build a bridge over a river so that their trains can use it, and builds the best damn bridge he can, and features a great climactic scene where some other soldiers are trying to destroy the bridge at the same time that the Japanese locomotive is going over it, and, you know, Lean is sort of shows us how somebody like a staunch British soldier could be conflicted. He doesn't want to see his bridge blown up. It's a very, very great film.
And a really interesting psychological portrait of this character here. I mean, why is he building this bridge? And where along the lines does he lose sight of what is really going on in the world around this little area of the concentration camp? The movie doesn't give you the cues about his changes in mentality. It just shows what happens, and you have to kind of think about what's going on.
And of course, it's also just a gorgeous movie. David Lean made epics like nobody else did, and beautiful cinematography and framing, and just a great grand epic psychological movie, which only Lean was able to do well.
Yeah. All right, so let's recap. My top six. Number six is Northwest Frontier. Number five is Danger Lights from 1930. Remember to see that one online. Number four is Murder on the Orient Express. Number three, The Great Train Robbery. Number two, The Lady Vanishes, the original one from 1938. And number one, The General.
And my list, number six is The Great Train Robbery. Number five is The French Connection. Number 4 is Le Samurai. Number 3, Some Like It Hot. Number 2, Strangers on a Train. And my top movie is really The General or The Bridge on the River Kwai. It doesn't matter.
You can make The General your number 0.
Yeah, it is. It goes one higher.
Sometimes it's interesting to talk about movies in pairs. I want to talk to you now about a couple of films released in 2003. If you only saw one of them, you probably saw the wrong one. It's sometimes said that the best criticism of a film is to make another film. Howard Hawks, for example, disliked the needy, dependent sheriff in High Noon, and so as a response to that, he made Rio Bravo. In this case, of course, both movies are pretty good. Now, when Big Fish came out during the Oscar season of 2003, its rebuttal had already been in theaters 3 months earlier. But let me talk about Big Fish first. It's a bittersweet story directed by Tim Burton about a guy whose father is dying, and he travels to his bedside to try to resolve the differences they've had between them most of their lives. The problem is that the son is a realist and wants to know who his father really is. But his father is a natural storyteller, and every time he talks about himself, which is often, he spins wildly improbable tales of whimsical adventures. Now, when Big Fish was released, there was a lot of anticipation that it might make a splash with Oscar voters. Ultimately, it did not, and I think I know why. But before I go further, let me outline our second film. It is called Secondhand Lions, and it came out in September of that year with a lot less fanfare. Like Big Fish, it's about a young man, in this case much younger, trying to get to know older family members through the fantastic stories they tell. Haley Joel Osment plays the young man, and his white trash mother dumps him off at the home of his two great uncles, partly just to be rid of him for a while, and partly so he can snoop around and find the fortune the uncles allegedly have stashed away somewhere. It certainly seems they've got money somewhere, but how much, and more importantly, how they got it, is a bit of a mystery. The uncles are played by Robert Duvall and Michael Caine. I think this movie showcases, maybe not the best, but perhaps the most entertaining and likable performances these two great actors have ever done. And yes, I do realize that that is really saying something. They play curmudgeonly characters, pretty cold and distant at first, but of course they all eventually warm up to each other. And Michael Caine's character starts telling the boy about their adventures as younger men, which involve war and sword fighting and lost love and all kinds of things. Is it all true, or are they just a couple of retired bank robbers? Now, both films have a lovely tone to them. Big Fish is broad and colorful and invigorating, and Secondhand Lions is whimsical, poignant. It has a lot of little pleasures that culminate in a great effect. It's the kind of film you chuckle a lot through just because of how much we have come to like these characters. By the way, Secondhand Lions is a great family film, one that kids will enjoy even though it's not really targeted at them. Both films delve deeply into the subject of storytelling, what it's for, what it does, how we as human beings absorb storytelling as a part of who we are. This is a fascinating subject for a lot of people like me who like to study film. This is a storytelling medium, and it's interesting sometimes to analyze how stories affect our lives. But here's the difference between the two movies. At the end of Secondhand Lions, we've come a long way. We've learned about these characters, and they've progressed in their relationships with each other. There's been growing up on one side and some redemption on the other. And if there are still some ambiguities about those stories, well, it doesn't much matter, because Osment's character has come to terms with how he feels about them, which is really the greater truth being sought here. The movie understands that what's important is how we decide to feel about people and treat people and trust people, and that's a compelling basis for a moving story. As for Big Fish, I did like the film, but ultimately I was disappointed with it because at the end we don't really seem to have gotten anywhere. We don't really know much more about the dying father than we did in the beginning, and neither does his son, really. Their relationship doesn't feel like it's reached a convincing closure because the characters are passive. They discover some things, but they don't really think about them and make decisions about how they feel about them. Consequently, compared to Secondhand Lions, Big Fish feels pretty empty of emotion. This is actually a problem Tim Burton seems to be constantly wrestling with. He's so good at bringing to life his own particular stylized vision of the world, and I like a lot of his films for that reason, but I don't think he's any further along than anybody else at understanding human nature, so he's not that good at pointing the way. Secondhand Lions, though, a highly rewarding film, fun, inventive, full of gentle humor. I enjoyed so much just spending time with these characters and empathized with all three. It goes without saying that I highly recommend it, especially if you saw Big Fish and liked where it was going, but didn't quite feel it got there.
Do you remember the trivia question from earlier in the show?
I do.
Okay, what was it?
It was a Best Picture winner that had received no other nominations.
Other than for Best Picture, that's right. Do you know the answer? Do you have a guess?
I don't know, Titanic.
Titanic. Well, you're close. Actually, it was Grand Hotel from 1932.
You know, that was actually at the back of my head, but I didn't want to say it because, you know, it would sound stupid if I was wrong. Whereas Titanic, really.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Grand Hotel's a great film, and it was actually the first real all-star ensemble picture, the kind that Robert Altman would base his career on, pretty much. I don't know why it didn't get at least a writing nomination, but I can tell you why it didn't get acting nominations. It's because everybody's a supporting actor. There's no leads, and they didn't have supporting actor categories at that time. It wasn't until 1937 that they got those.
Records from that era are sketchy at best, I'd say. And that's about it. But remember, we come out every Tuesday, but our website, allmovietalk.com, it's the name of the show, allmovietalk.com, is updated all the time with all sorts of interesting info and news and discussion about movies. So if you can't get enough of our podcast, check back regularly to the website.
Also check out rinkworks.com. That's rink like a skating rink. Next episode of this podcast, that's next Tuesday, we're going to be talking about movie theaters and the different ways in which people are now viewing movies other than the traditional movie theaters. We'll also have a new trivia question, of course, and continue talking about James Bond, and we'll have a discussion about The Third Man, which is a great movie, so you won't want to miss it.
Cut!